Welcome to the OME Talks podcast. I'm your host, David Petro. This is the first of two OME 2025 preview episodes where we will talk to the featured and keynote speakers from this year's upcoming annual conference in Oshawa. In this episode, we're going to be hearing from the featured speakers and keynote speakers from day one of the conference. And just so you know the difference, we have three types of speakers at the conference. We have the regular speakers from the breakout sessions who are all those that put their proposals in, and from all the submissions, the OME 2025 program team chose the best ones. There's usually between 10 and 20 breakout sessions for each time slot to choose from. Next are the feature speakers. These are the speakers that have been specially invited by the program committee, and there is typically one of these running in almost every time slot. So in most time slots, you can choose from a single feature speaker or a bunch of breakout sessions. Finally, we have the keynote speakers. For keynotes, they are invited by the program committee, and that is the only session running at that time slot for all participants to see. So now that you've got that all figured out, let's get to our featured speakers, and we're going to start with Robert Deroche. So I'm speaking with Robert Deroche. Robert, how are you doing?
I'm great, thanks. Keeping warm on a cold winter's night.
It's a little bit cold, yes. Robert, I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do.
Certainly. My name's Robert Deroche. I'm Métis on my dad's side and French-Canadian. Currently, I work at the Art Gallery of Ontario as the Richard and Elizabeth Curry Chief of Education Programming. I've been there for the last 4 months. Love it because I am an arts-based educator. And previously to that, I was working at the Urban Indigenous Education Center with the Toronto District School Board as an administrator and then as an instructional leader that really looked at centering STEAM and STEM-based learning through Indigenous perspectives and also making connections to Indigeneity and math.
Okay, that's a healthy resume. I'm intrigued by your current role, but that's not what we're here to talk about. We are here to talk about you as being one of our featured speakers for OME 2025. Robert, can you tell us a little bit about what your session is going to be about?
So my session is really focusing on storytelling, math, the land, connections to the arts. And so one of the things I really try to do is to start off by asking participants that engage with my session is to really think about what are their experiences with math when they were in school and how have those experiences impact who they are? And then I go on to look at the way that artists tell stories through the creations they make. I think about the stories that are connected to the land and weave all that together and get people to think about the importance of storytelling within math, looking at the land and looking at math and the way that some artists intentionally engage math, whereas sometimes they don't, but that math opens up a whole world of storytelling through art and through the land, and really trying to look at de-siloing, right? So a colonial way of engagement is very colonial, right? We have math, we have science, we have art, we have English, whatever. And what I'm trying to do is trying to break apart and understand that there's art and math, math and art, that we engage in storytelling on the land, there's mathematics, there's art. It's all interwoven. And the purpose of that really is to think about holistic learners. So ourselves as a holistic educator and learner, and the students that we work with as holistic beings, and that we need to feed their well-being through their spirit and their body, their minds and hearts, of course.
So can you think of a really quick example of how you can weave storytelling in mathematics?
Certainly. Thank you for that. So what I might do, for example, is I might turn to a story that was written by an author that has connections to land in it and stories. So for example, there's some great literature out there, illustrated literature for kids and youth that talk about 13 moons. And so what I might do is I might start to read that story out loud and see how math informs the story and the story is informed by patterns and cycles.
So when you're looking at that and you're talking to teachers, what is it that you're going to tell a teacher who maybe this isn't part of their regular day to help convince them to incorporate that into their lessons?
Well, and this is why I start with a very personal, right? So I ask someone to think about, like, who's that math teacher that really connected with you and what is it that they did? And then I also sometimes ask, like, oh, think of a time where your math teacher wasn't so great. What was it that happened? And it's through those stories that I get people to think about, like, what were the conditions in the classroom? So what were the way the teacher treated you? How was the classroom set up? What was the structure? How did they engage you in math that made it something you enjoy? So the richness of that story gets one to think about, well, what is it that I need to have in my classroom so that students engage, so they feel that they're being heard, included, and talked for?
Okay. So now we don't want you to give us your whole talk right now. So I thank you for that brief introduction to what you're going to be talking about. We look forward to hearing and seeing you this May at OME 2025.
I'm looking forward to it too.
That was Robert DeRoche talking about storytelling and math. Also on Thursday, we have Jason Toe. So let's hear from Jason. So I'm talking with Jason Toe. Jason, how are you doing?
I'm good. How are you, David?
Good. So Jason, I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about what you do.
Well, I currently have the privilege of serving as the coordinator of mathematics and academic pathways for the Toronto District School Board. So I have responsibilities to support K-12 math instruction and system improvement in math, and also in our continued efforts to tackle, address, and eliminate streaming structures from kindergarten to grade 12. So I have the privilege of working with a number of school math facilitators, what we call them, math learning partners in the TDSB. We have about 25 of them, and they're a wonderful team to work with. So I feel really blessed to be able to work with a really talented group of people that are making a real difference in classrooms and in our district as a whole.
Okay. And you are one of our featured speakers this year at OME 2025. I wonder if you could give us a little bit of a sense of what you are going to be talking about this coming May.
Yeah. A topic that's been really on my mind for the last couple years now is this ongoing debate around inquiry-based learning versus explicit or direct instruction. There is this tension that continues to exist, particularly around, I'd say right now, in stakeholders, our public. You know, the public is really taking an interest in math education, as they should. And with that kind of heightened scrutiny around what we do in teaching and learning math, that, you know, these kinds of ideas around inquiry and these ideas around how we could perhaps be more deliberate or be more explicit in the teaching that we do in classrooms around math is something that's been coming up a lot. And I hear that a lot. And I want to make sure that teachers are understanding of what the evidence says around, you know, these approaches. I'm of the mind that, you know, teaching and learning is so complicated. Like, you can't just do the same thing all the time or one thing all the time. You have a very diverse group of students in front of you. Every teacher does. And there is no one size fits all. It's really a matter of having tools in your tool belt. And there's going to be times when explicit instruction is going to be the right way to go. There's going to be times where inquiry is the way to go. But I'm not sure yet if everybody is on the same page as to, like, when one is good and when one is better and when you ought not to do one. And it's also this idea that it's also a quality, right? Quality in how you use these approaches. I think that really matters too. And so my session is, you know, really just spewing out the things that I've learned and the, you know, the nuances that come with teaching that I hope allow teachers, when they come, if they come to the session, that they'll walk away being like, okay, I have a better sense of when I use this approach or when I might think about that approach. and some of the things I might need to keep an eye on when I'm using either of them.
So if I'm hearing you right, the session is not about you saying which one is the best and should use all the time.
That's right. And honestly, like I said, what one classroom looks like in Toronto, it looks very different than one in North Bay. And that school in North Bay will have two different classrooms where there's two different cohorts of students and different strengths and challenges. So there is no, like I am certain that there is not one way to teach everybody and anything. So really, this is where teacher expertise comes in. And so my session is hoping to try to just sharpen that expertise.
So, you know, I am definitely with you in the sense that you know, there's absolutely no one way to do teaching, even from teaching the same subject or same course year or semester after semester, because you have different students every time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I'm wondering, you know, how do you approach a teacher who is sort of stuck in one of those extremes? Like, you know, either always inquiry, has to be always inquiry, or always explicit. Like, how do you get them to move away from, you know, more towards the center of the two?
Yeah, you know, one of the things that people have pointed out throughout this debate is, you know, the focus is, of course, on making sure students learn and understand the mathematics. There's different goals also, though, more explicit to each of them. So, you know, as an example, inquiry-based instruction, there's evidence that, you know, students are more likely to be creating a sense of self as a math learner when they are given an opportunity to try to figure something out. So, like, if there is a teacher that is really leaning only in explicit instruction, a question could be, well, how are students here in this class feeling about themselves as a math learner? If they're being told what to do all the time, is there an opportunity that allows them to show what they can do or who they are and what original ideas they might have when it comes to approaching a problem? And the same thing goes in the inquiry side too. You know, there might be a procedure that really would be a lot more efficient if a teacher clearly modeled it and provide opportunities for students to practice it, like through a guided way, so that a teacher kind of checks and sees, are students getting it? And if they aren't, then there's another opportunity for them to improve whatever, you know, process they're trying to learn. Because, I mean, I think a really skilled educator can make anything into an inquiry, I think, but it might take a really long time in order to make that happen. And we know that there's a time constraint in teaching, especially, well, I mean, in any, whether it's an elementary or secondary. So that has to be a consideration, like, as well in reality. So I think, you know, what I'm going to try to do is just get people to think a little bit more about, well, what are the merits of these approaches? Like, what are some of the pitfalls of these approaches, so that teachers just basically walk away feeling a little bit more secure about both of these? Because I think teachers generally do some mix of both to some degree, like whether it's really high on one and lower on the other or vice versa. So, you know, really making sure that teachers feel like they're more intentional and deliberate about these. That's really what I'm hoping people walk away from the session.
Okay, so we are looking forward to both hearing and seeing you in Oshawa this May. So Jason, thanks for talking to us today.
Yeah, it's my pleasure.
And we'll see you at OME. That was Jason talking about the false dichotomy between explicit teaching and inquiry. And now our last featured speaker from the day, Lisa Lenny-Borden. I'm talking with Lisa Lenny-Borden. Lisa, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, hi. I'm the John Jerome Paul Chair for Equity in Math Education at St. Francis Xavier University, which means I get to spend a lot of time thinking about equity in mathematics. I also currently serve as the chair of the Department of Teacher Education at St. FX, And I get to work with lots of pre-service teachers talking about math and all kinds of other things relating to teaching.
And you are one of our featured speakers at OME 2025 this year. I'm wondering if you could tell us what your session, well, let's start with what your session is called, and then what will we see you doing there?
Sure. The title of my session is called Equity and Assessment, Valuing Community Ways of Knowing in Mathematics Assessment. And so I've talked a lot over the years at OEME about pedagogy and engagement and how to bring Indigenous knowledge into your teaching. And something that I've been doing a lot of work on lately is thinking about what that means for assessment. That's a big question we often get is, you know, we figured out how to teach this stuff. How do we assess this stuff? And so I've been working on developing a holistic math assessment with Sprigg Learning out of Ottawa for pre-K up to first grade mathematics. I'm also doing some work with Mi'kmaq Inuma'atnuwe around decolonizing mathematics and thinking about decolonizing assessment in mathematics in particular, and how do we do a better job of assessment. So we'll be bringing in some of that learning into the session this year on thinking about what do we do around assessment and making it a more equitable experience for Indigenous kids in particular, but all kids really.
So I think that's really important, because I've often said that, you know, great teaching can be undone by poorly thought out assessment. And so, like, you know, what are some things that you might tell teachers to help bring their assessment to be more meaningful and more fair to students, or more equitable to students?
Yeah, I think, you know, we'll talk a lot about the importance of formative assessment, obviously. So much of assessment is something that's done to kids instead of with children, right? Like, it tends to be an event rather than an ongoing experience. So really thinking about how can we create tools that help us to see growth in mathematical thinking over time. One of the things I've been working on in particular is thinking about mathematical processes and how do we see those processes playing out. So, you know, years ago, NCTM came up with their processes of, you know, reasoning and proof, communication, connections, multiple representations, problem solving. We talk about visualization, things like that. There's lots of different processes that have come out in different curricula documents across the country. But what does that look like? What does it look like to evaluate someone's reasoning? And so I've actually developed a framework based on some work done by some Canadian colleagues, Carolyn Kieran and Doris Janet, and really kind of using their framework of reasoning and proof to break down what it looks like and to help teachers to see, you know, what is reasoning. And so there's this, I'll give you one little example. We have this fun little activity. We have a bear called Aliette who supports some of the math work we're doing in Mi'kmaq Inuma'atnuwe. And so we do this task called Aliette's Favorite Things, and we whisper a sorting rule into Aliette's ear, and then the kids take turns giving her different objects. Maybe they're different colors of objects or different kinds of objects, and they have to guess her sorting rule based on which ones she likes and which ones she doesn't like. And so that's a great example of an assessment that can help you to see kids' reasoning by engaging in that, you know, how are they thinking about it? What are their strategies that they're using? What kinds of choices are they making as they're trying to figure out the sorting rule? And so we've been talking a lot about kind of assessing not just content, but process. And how can we really get a better understanding of children's thinking?
And do you have a specific grade band that you're looking at here?
We're mostly looking at elementary, but I was a high school teacher by trade. So I always like to think about what it looks like right from K to 12. Some of the examples will be more elementary focused, but I'll try to kind of broaden that into what would it look like in high school as well.
Okay, so that gives us a little bit of a sense of what you'll be talking about this year at OME 2025. So Lisa, thanks for talking to us today.
No problem.
And we will see you at the conference.
Yeah, looking forward to being there.
That was Lisa Lenny-Borden speaking about equity and assessment. Now our keynote on Thursday is Camille Jones Ford, and we're going to hear a bit about who she is and what her keynote address will be about. Okay, so I'm speaking with Camille Jones Ford. Camille, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you?
That is great to hear. I'm doing good myself. Camille, you're going to be one of our keynote speakers this year at OME 2025. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do.
Yes, I am so excited to present. I currently teach mathematics to 6th, 7th, and 8th graders at a private school in Atlanta, Georgia, called Ron Clark Academy. But I've been teaching for, this is my 25th year teaching, believe it or not. I started teaching high school first for 7 years in the Atlanta public school system in Atlanta, Georgia. And then I needed a break, needed a little bit of a break. I decided to go back to school, but of course I couldn't stop teaching. So it wasn't a real break. I ended up being an elementary math coach in Harlem, New York City, while I got my doctorate at Columbia University in New York. And then I came back to Atlanta to work at Ron Clark Academy. So I've been teaching at the elementary school level, the high school level, the middle school level, and a little bit of college online as well.
Okay, so that sounds like a great career spanning many grades. I love that. You know, I'm sort of been in the teaching biz myself for over 30 years, so it's always good to hear somebody else's story. Like I said, you're going to be one of our keynotes. I think you're doing our Thursday keynote. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about what you're going to be speaking on.
Sure. So mainly what I'm going to talk about is the idea of fighting math anxiety with building math esteem. And so I love using that phrase, math esteem, helping students have self-efficacy and really think positively about math. And more than just using growth mindset, of course, that's important, but having them understand that, you know, they can be mathematicians. They don't have to be the fastest, or they don't have to work the hardest. They just have to believe that they can do it, and then see the little small successes as ways to help them have larger successes. And that's kind of what I'm going to show. I'm going to show some great examples of way to do that in each type of classroom, whether it's, you know, different grade levels, private or public, and then different types of ways to do it with the different types of learners there are, whether you're a kinesthetic learner, an audio learner, a visual learner, just different ways to get the kids excited about math, and showing practical ways that teachers can do that and educators can do that. I'm also going to talk about ways to change the community's mentality about math. You know, far too often, especially in the math community, we'll hear outsiders say, oh, that's great, you guys are great at math, but you know, I couldn't do it. I could never do what you do. And those kind of messages get put out into the community where people who are not mathematicians or don't consider themselves to be mathematicians might help bring those ideas of math being not being important or math not being something fun to do out into the mindsets of students. And then it's hard to fight that as well. So ways to help the whole community think positively about math and speak positively about math.
So I think I've experienced a lot of the same thing, you know, when I have parents that talk about their children and they say, oh, you know, I was never good at math.
Yes.
And I, you know, it almost, when they say that to their children, it's almost as if they're giving their children
an out,
an excuse not to worry about it. So how do you combat that? What do you do to help that?
You know, honestly, it takes a lot of talking to everyone. So what we do is we do workshops for the parents. And we kind of teach them how they are mathematicians without actually doing computational math. Like putting on an outfit every day is doing math. You got to figure out the patterns, what works best. Figuring out how to get to work every day is mathematical. Using the same problem-solving skills to read a map, to follow a map, to follow directions. And people don't think about math that way. They think mainly about sales and stores and computation, and not about the conceptual understanding of number sense and problem-solving. And so really having discussions with parents and all the community members about the right ways of saying things, instead of saying, I can't help you with your homework because I don't know how to do it, saying things like, what resources do you have? Do you have any notes from your teacher? Let's see what we can find online. Like giving them the tools of things to say instead of being so defeatist and so negative about the subject is what we kind of help everyone do. And not just parents, but also fellow coworkers. People that teach social studies class or science class may be like, I can't help you, but there's got to be a better way they can say those things. And I know that in my school, every now and then a teacher might slip up and they look right at me in the face like, oops, I didn't mean to say that. They try to correct it because they know that they're trying to make sure they're not giving it out for the students or making the students think, you know, they couldn't do it, so I don't have to do it either. Like they have to make math important. The way they do a reading, nobody wants to say they can't read. Right? So we have to be able to do the same thing with mathematics.
Yeah, it's almost as if people are proud to say they can't do math.
They're very proud. It's in movies, it's in the media, it's all over the place. So it's going to take a lot of us to try and change that.
So now you're going to be talking to teachers here at our conference, but when you are giving some of your messaging, do you talk a different way to teachers as you would to, say, some of your students? Or what are some of the commonalities that you might see there?
I think that, honestly, a lot of the things are parallel. You know, just the example I gave before about if you're fast at math, it means you're better at math. That's something that happens that students think and teachers. There's some teachers that think that you have to do timed assessments to be good at math, like you have to do it fast, right? So it's students are not getting that from, you know, themselves. They're getting that from some of their educators. So it's like changing that mentality. You know, Albert Einstein was really slow at figuring out stuff, you know, and he's a genius. So it's not about speed. So giving examples like that, fighting those misconceptions is the first way of breaking things down.
Yeah, and I totally agree. You know, I've heard lots of interviews with mathematicians, and a lot of times they talk about the slowness that they do math.
Yes.
And you know, I've heard Roger Penrose talk about the fact that he almost flunked out of, I think, grade 4 or grade 5 because he just couldn't do the math fast enough. Mm-hmm. I wonder if he didn't have that one teacher that was able to give him that extra time to show that he could do the work, if we would have some of the ideas that he's put forth. So yeah, I totally get that. So when you are looking at taking these ideas, and let's focus in maybe on the idea of, you know, math anxiety, what is like one sort of go-to? Do you have a single go-to that you kind of reach to, you know, is the easy place to go for teachers?
Yeah. Anytime you can find a way to connect the material that they're learning to something real world. And I know a lot of people say something that the kids care about, that's important. But if you can find anything that's real world in general, that's also great. Like the other day, we were dealing with quadratic formula and dealing with quadratic equations and how to solve them. And one of the students was like, when am I ever going to worry about factoring? You know, when is factoring ever going to be important? And we were able to find a real world connection that when a ship starts to sink or is somewhere lost in the ocean, they have to search a region of the ocean to see. They search by region, by region, by region to try and find that ship. Where the regions, that little box area they're trying to search for, is like a quadratic expression. It's a binomial times a binomial. They're searching x plus 3 times x plus 5. They're searching that region on the x and y axis on the grid to try and find that that ship. And that's an example of how you use quadratic expressions and how solving for that variable, that x, would be a such quadratic equation in real world. So having that understanding of how they could use it in real life really does help students put value into the math they're trying to learn. Otherwise, they're just doing just, you know, stuff they don't care about at all. It's just memorization of procedure, memorization of computation, and there's no understanding of wealth of knowledge. And I think that's what makes everything important. The reason why people like reading is because they see how they got to read every day, right? They got to see how it applies to their real life, but they're not seeing how the math they're learning applies to real life. So the more examples, no matter how small they are, that teachers can find for each topic, not for the big ones like going to the store, but like each topic that they're teaching, it'll help the students connect to the material and have better math esteem. They won't have anxiety with it because they understand why it's relevant.
Okay. So we look forward to hearing from you expand on these ideas as one of our keynotes at OME 2025. So Camille, thank you for talking with us today.
Thank you so much.
Seeing you and hearing you in May.
Yes, most definitely. I'm excited.
That was Camille Jones Ford telling us that she is focusing on fighting math anxiety by looking at math esteem. So that's the day one featured and keynote speakers. Plus, don't forget, there will be almost 100 other sessions that day. Registration is open now, and you can register at our MCAS registration site. The link can be found in the episode description. And just a note about registration. One of the things I like so much about registering for the OME conferences is that you pick your sessions ahead of time when you register. That ensures that on the day of the conference, you'll always get the sessions you want. And when you register, don't forget to register for your lunch choices, and for fun, maybe the games night or the bowling night. Well, that's it for this OME preview episode. Stay tuned for next week for a preview of day two of this year's OME conference, where we will hear about the day's featured and keynote speakers. And until then, stay safe.